Hi, and thank you for having me. This talk will be held in English. There was a little confusion about this on the internet. So, hello and welcome. I would like to start with before starting to talk about, go in depth into the topic. I would like to do two little acknowledgements that are dear to me. One is that it's a really great honor to be presenting something at the Chaos Computer Club conference that I've been following for a very long time, and I've always wanted to participate, and it somehow never worked out. And I think there is somebody who would be really glad to see me here. He was a very dear friend of mine in Cologne, and he used to be the chairperson of Chaos Computer Club in Cologne, back in the back a couple of years ago. So, for those of you who still remember Chromie, I'm honored to be here, and I'm sure he's looking. He died in an accident 10 years ago, and I still really miss him. I dedicate this session to Chromie. And the second thing is that everything, or many, many things that I'm about to say now, are actually that I owe them. I owe this wisdom to Indigenous people. So I would like to acknowledge that most of the stuff that I'm going to explain to you now is something that Indigenous people have been knowing for millions of millions, thousands of years, and it's white Western society that has almost destroyed that knowledge and that has forgotten about these things. So the problem that we have today with the criminal justice system, that is a white problem, in the sense of where it is a white invention. And even if I'm going to quote also white and academics, most of the roots of these knowledgement systems are indigenous. And also, very recently, it's the Black Lives Matter movement that has pushed these things a lot forward, which is maybe also the reason why you're joining, because you might have heard of criminal of penal abolition, and restorative justice and transformative justice because of the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm going to do an old school talk. That means there is no PowerPoint. There is no technical thingies. I just have my hands and my mouth, and you have your ears. And I think that that is not a bad thing, because restorative justice is about learning to listen, and in order to really understand each other, and also about learning to communicate, learning to talk so that people can understand. So I will do my best to speak in a way that you can easily follow me, and I hope that you can concentrate and listen with your heart and pay attention, be concentrated and stay focused. There is a difficulty because you and I, we're separated by this screen. I can't see you. I don't know how many of you are there. I can't feel your presence. I can't see your reactions. There is no dynamic between us. I'm going to have to rely on you sending messages via Twitter or in the chat rooms of this conference, or maybe there's a chat function in the streaming. I'm warmly inviting you to use them, and to ask questions, but also to comment, and to make statements. Everything is welcome. And our presenters will do their best to feed that back into the Q&A session that will come after when I've, you know, finished my presentation. My presentation will be free, you know, in the sense that there is no script. I'm just going to, you know, walk a little path with you about the different aspects of penal abolition and alternatives to it. And there are so many aspects to that I'm not going to cover all of it. And there will be so many more questions once I've finished. So that's normal. So we'll see what I'm going to say. I never really know what I'm going to say when I start, because, you know, there are so many things to say and I can never say them all. And there's a pledge I would like to make, even though it's cool to have this conference online and to, you know, and to be able to present despite of this difficult situation that the world is in right now. But I think physical, real, like, connection cannot be replaced by online tools, by online media. So do not let this better than nothing solution become the new reality. We should really hold dearly how important it is for us as human beings to be in touch and to be in contact, to see each other, to touch each other, and to feel each other's energy, to feel each other's presence. It makes all the difference. So I am, as it's been said before, I'm Resi Malzahn. I'm coming to you right now from France, which is where I live part-time. The other half, I'm in Germany. When I'm in Germany, I'm mostly in Cologne. And I started dealing with questions of penal abolitionism as a young activist, as a young anarchist activist, you could say, somebody who would, you know, protest and resist against injustices, and who would hence face repression. And there was this little ritual that we did, and that I liked a lot, that on New Year's Eve, and I don't know if it's still done, we used to go to a local prison in Cologne and make a demo, and, you know, in order to wish the prisoners a happy new year, you know, as the best you could, and, you know, to remind them that we haven't forgotten them, and that we wish for a society where prisons were unnecessary. And this has seemed to be quite radical to me, and that's why I liked it. But I always lacked answers on what we could do instead. And, you know, the prison is a very cruel institution. We know this. You know, the critique of the prison is as old as the prison itself. Many of you might have read Michel Foucault's work on this, on punishment and surveillance, and, you know, his work on how in history prison has evolved, and you know what its functions are, and how it doesn't work and how it's never worked, and so, yeah, obviously, if you think of it, then it's easy to criticize prison. I mean, I can do this quickly, but it's not really my the core or the most important thing for me, because I think we need to dig even much deeper. But, you know, to give you maybe a brief oversight on what prison is about, you know, prison is basically putting people in cages, thinking that if you do that, you know, with the intention, actually, that they will become, that they would think about their acts and become better humans. But prison is actually the most brutal and violent place in a society. It's not at all designed in order to make people better humans. I don't know if you've ever had to struggle with something that you did, and I don't know if you've ever imagined what you needed in order to overcome a certain behavior of yours. I mean, most of the time, I imagine that you would realize that you need support, that you might need psychological help, that you might need tight friendships, that you might need a good social support group around you, or you know, peace, or open space, or nature, or you know, various things. All these things are not provided in prison. Many people come out of prison in a worse state, health and in a worse physical and mental health state than they were in when they went in. So already it's not really doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to make people think about their acts, and you know, it's supposed to deter. So you can, you know, many studies have shown that the deterrence effect doesn't really work, that many violent deeds are being done when people are in an emotional state where they actually don't think about the consequences. So many of these violent things aren't actually stopped by the existence of prison. Some people who are professional criminals will take it into consideration as a risk of their job. So, you know, it doesn't really stop people from doing things. And then, you know, and then there's this whole group that seems to be above the law. And society's been discussing this quite a lot recently. In this group are policemen. Police and other members of the criminal justice system are very rarely convicted of their wrongdoing. So they can basically assume that they won't have any consequences. So that doesn't apply to them. And the same goes for rich and powerful people. So if you look at who's in prison, it's mainly punishing the poor. It's people who have people who are poor, people who live in precarious situations. A lot of people with POCs, people who have migration backgrounds. And it's mainly people who have done minor harms, or even have done things that don't actually harm anybody, like taking public transport without paying, or selling drugs, which doesn't actually, the act in itself doesn't actually harm anybody. So there's a very old saying that goes, if the best criminal policy is always a good social policy, because people find themselves in prison because of their life circumstances, because they might not be able to afford certain things, and so on and so forth. So you rarely see rich people or powerful people in prison. But that's not my point, actually. My point is rather, so what do we want to achieve? Like, what is the whole point? And does that actually work? Like, so most of the time when you ask people, so why do we need punishment? People go like, yeah, but you know, we need to show people that their acts are not okay, and we need to protect ourselves. And yeah, I completely agree with this. We need to show people that, you know, there are limits, that we as society or as community or as individuals, we have limits, and there are certain things that we don't want them, you know, that we don't want to happen, and we don't want to be hurt, and we don't want to be damaged. we want to be respected and heard and all these things. And we want to be safe. So the question is, does the criminal justice system, in the way that it is set up, does it deliver this? And if you look at how our society is, I don't really see that. I see that people who are hurt are still hurting, that they rarely receive what they need in order to move on. I see that many harms actually aren't illegal, so therefore they don't even apply. I see that many harms that are illegal are addressed in a way that doesn't, meet the victim's needs, or that doesn't make our society any safer. Because if we punish somebody, so basically when we punish somebody, we have this idea, I'm gonna do a little act performance here. We have this idea that justice has gotten out of balance. So you all know this statue of Lady Justice with the balance, right? And so if somebody does something, harms somebody, does harm, inflicts harm, it gets out of balance. So we can, this is what it would look like, right? And now the idea is that if we, in order to get this balance right, we need to, get that scale up. And what we do is, so if this is the harmed person, and this would be the wrongdoer, right? So we inflict pain on the person who has harmed the other person in order to, get this right. But what we actually do is we inflict harm. So the result we've got is that both sides are down. Because by inflicting harm on this side, we haven't actually taken away any pain on this side. We haven't restored anything. We've just inflicted more pain. Because after, one person hurting, we now have another person, so now we have two persons hurting. Does that make any sense? Not so much to me. And also, what is the communicative act that we're doing? What do we tell that person? So yeah, you could say we tell that person we don't like what you do, what you did. It's and we don't want you to do that. Yeah, maybe. But often, people who hurt other people or people who commit acts that are considered illegal or harmful or wrong. Because I don't really go by, I don't really care if it's legal or illegal. To me, it's more important, does it harm people? And what consequences does it have on community, on society, on another person, or another living being? Maybe we communicate to that person that we didn't like the act, but many of these people actually don't understand the message that way. And that has to do with the fact that we, all of us, or most of us, have a positive image of ourselves. So when we do things, and we all always have a reason, like I'm sure all of you have a reason why you do things. And even if that is a little torn up reason, it's still a reason. And it's a reason that makes sense to you. So if you do something that hurts another person, and we just punish you without listening to what you have to say about this, you may actually feel treated unjust. And this is what happens to many people. They feel unheard and they feel treated unjust because they did what they did for a reason, even if this reason is for us really weird or not valid. For them, it has an importance. And if we neglect that, then we actually diminish the chance that this person wants to cooperate and wants to look at what they did, because they feel like we don't care about them. We don't care about their reason. We don't want, and there's an interesting theory about this kind of act that Elias Canetti, I could say he was a real cosmopolitan white man of the 20th century, who wrote, amongst other, in German, and who's been living in Austria for a while. So maybe that gives you a little idea of his whereabouts. He has this theory of a thorn. So whenever, and he applies this, like he developed it in the context of analyzing fascism and of analyzing how violent acts, what kind of impact violent acts had on other people. So he was like, so when somebody gives an order, and an order is a violent thing because you're forced to do something that you may not want to do, okay? So if I send out an order, I send out like a thorn, and this thorn will hurt the other person, and it will sting, right? So people who are oppressed receive many, many stings, and people who oppress send out many, many stings. And people collect these stings, and it makes them angry. And there's two ways of getting rid of stings, because you want to get rid of these thorns because they hurt. Either you can pass them on by, you know, oppressing somebody else, or you can return them by making a revolution, for example. And this creates fear in the people who give out these orders, because they know that thorns sting and people don't want this. People hurt, and they will maybe want revenge one day. And you know, we can apply this kind of theory to punishment, because punishment works in quite a similar way as an order does. It makes you're made to do something or to suffer from something you didn't agree to. So either you have to pay a fine, or you have to go to prison, or you have to wear shackles, or you have to, in any case, you're put in a situation that you didn't choose, and you're not asked. So you receive a thorn, and that makes you more reluctant to think of what you did, and you might, you know, you resist, you have this inner resistance, and you will want to, you know, maybe revenge on society, or you engage in self-pity and so on and so forth. But what we as society want from these people is that they think about what they did and that they change their ways. But that is not a very appropriate mean of getting there. And there is another critique of this. It's a way of forgetting that we are all connected in society, and in actually on this planet, in life, we're all connected, and we all have very many aspects in ourselves. So none of you would like to be defined by just one aspect of their personality. Like, for example, you probably wouldn't want to be defined just as a parent, or just as a athlete, or just as a thief, or just as the person who always lies. So the liar. Because, you know, you, depending on who you're with, you may show different aspects of yourself. And you might realize that with some people you feel more joyous, or you're more open, and with some people you're more closed, or you're more, or, you know, firm. You might find yourself in different roles. You might be different when you're a parent talking to your kid, than when you're talking to your friends, or you might talk to your friends differently than you do to the person that you're in relationship with. What the criminal justice system and what we as society do is we define people, as somebody famously said, by their worst moments. Somebody has committed a murder, somebody has killed somebody else, and then we go on and define them as a murderer. We will talk of that person as the murderer. Even if it's been 20 years ago, it'll be like, Ah, oh, you know, that's such and such, but he murdered somebody. He's a murderer. Or we will, you know, that's like a, that's a stigmatizing label that people will never ever get rid of. And we sort of, you know, we reduce them to that, and we're like, yeah, because he's a murderer or she's a murderer, they deserve, like, you know, we need to punish them. And we need to, you know, lock them up because apparently they're dangerous and so on and so forth. And that makes us, you know, it separates us. So first of all, so there are two aspects, sorry, sometimes difficult to talk when I can't see you and to concentrate on my string of thought. So there are two aspects that are problematic in the whole concept of the way we deal with this. They are, first of all, we forget that people have many aspects. Well, there are three. So we forget people have many aspects of their personality. We forget that people have good reasons for their acts, and that people evolve. So basically, we have a static view, a very, very static view of persons, of humans. And we just, you know, we put them in boxes and then they rest in that box forever. And we also forget that we're not separate from them, and that somehow we all create each other. How can I explain that? We all, you know, when And it's, you know, at the beginning, this innocent little child that you have in your arms. And then, you know, later on in life, they do things, and they behave in a certain way. So every one of us has been created by society. So we all are sort of share a collective responsibility for how people who people become. So in our mass societies, that is a very abstract thing, right? So if you live in a tight-knit community, that is so much more direct, that is so much more easy to understand. But still, we cannot neglect the fact that people don't, you know, murder people who murder other people, or people who do horrendous things to each other, that doesn't fall from the sky. That doesn't come out of the blue. That is something that has been created by a society that is structured by mechanisms of oppression and exploitation, and that puts people into certain situations where some have more choice than others. You know, we construct gender, we construct classes, we construct race and all these kinds of things, and we are, as a society, in different positions, but we do create each other. And actually, we're not better than the other one. What the white criminal justice system allows us to do by locking up people and by defining them by their crime is to give us the impression that they are the problem. And by putting, you know, by putting them away, it's like, okay, we put this person into a cage and it's it, fine, we're safe. And that is not the case, because we all have our little, you know, dark sides. We all have our behaviors. We are so much closer, actually, to inflicting serious harm to somebody else than we think. So there's actually not us, the good people outside of prison, and them, or the bad people inside of prison. This is that is a wrong image. We are so much more connected. We're so much more the same than we would like to think. And you know, there are some of the most serious or hurtful, painful things that people do to each other, apart from, you know, inflicting, you know, violent and physical and emotional and mental violence on each other, or killing each other, is what is sexual violence, and that, or sexualized violence. And it is something that that people get very passionate about, especially on how we should deal with it. But thinking about my own past, I have been on both ends. I maybe I would be I would have even supported penal solutions, so punishment solutions for this kind of thing. But you know, thinking about penal abolition and getting inspired by Indigenous and Black theories about this, I've been thinking about myself and about what I about my life, and I realized that I'm not only a victim, I'm also a perpetrator. I've also inflicted harm on people. I have transgressed limits and boundaries. I have, you know, I've done emotional and psychological harm. So I can't say this is, you know, the perpetrator, and I'm the angel. That's not what it's like. And then I come to think, okay, so what, in which circumstances would I be ready to talk about this? In which circumstances would I feel safe to say, look, this is what I did, and this is how I feel about it? Well, certainly not in a situation where I have to fear being excluded, being punished, being shamed, being stigmatized. And it's funny because one of the contemporary white theorists that I like a lot is a French guy called Geoffroy de Lagannerie, who wrote a wonderful book a couple of years ago, I think 2018. The Penal State on Trial is called. And he said, when I did an interview with him, he said to me, look, you know, in some places of society, we know this. So, and he told me this story about the civil air traffic in authority in France, who is in charge of the security and safety of airplanes for, you know, civil air traffic. And they have this method where they, whenever there's a problem occurred during a flight, they have this policy that pilots have total amnesty, but they're obliged to tell the truth. And why do they do this? Because they know that if they threaten pilots with punishment, pilots have an interest to not say the truth. For example, to not say that they were drunk. Which they're not supposed to be, but it might occur. So that maybe the problem occurred because they were drunk. They would say, oh, I don't know, there's a technical problem. They would be looking for that technical problem for ages and they wouldn't find it. So they need to know, in order to have a civil air traffic safe, they need for pilots to say the truth. And in order for pilots to be able to say the truth, they need these pilots to not fear punishment, right? And that is, you know, so logical. So could we not deal with harm and wrongdoing in society different? Yes, we can. And actually, there are lots of alternatives. They weren't known to the ordinary activists back in the days when I participated in this demonstration at the Cologne prison. Back then, people always said, oh, you know, that question of what could we do instead, that is something that future generations or future societies after the revolution need to sort out. And that's bullshit. These solutions are real, they exist, and they always have, actually. And that's the crazy thing. Actually, the big constant way of dealing with wrongdoing and harm in human history is to make good, to talk about it and to make good and to restore and to repair. So most of the time, people would sit in a circle and talk to each other and listen to each other. And the people affected would say how it harmed them and how they feel and what they need. And the people responsible for that harm would say why they did it and you know what their problem is and how they came to act that way and they would find out what they needed from each other and how they could, you know, what they could deal out, what they could negotiate in order to keep, you know, continue living in peace with each other. And there would be more people involved than just the people who are directly involved. There would be the community involved. There would be maybe the people of the family or, you know, the neighbors or other people who are affected and concerned involved. Because people lived, humans have always been living before creating these large mass society civilizations. Humans have been living in the knowledge that we all create each other, and that we are closely connected, and that therefore we have a collective responsibility. And this collective responsibility is completely ruled out in the criminal justice system. It's always the individual's fault. As when you start to criticize society and the unjust structures of society and the systems of oppression, then we know that there is certainly, you know, there is a certain amount of personal responsibility of how I deal with something, and I am responsible for my acts and for their consequences, of course, but that is just part of the truth. Another part of the truth is that I came to be in that situation where I acted like that by a society that put me there. And so we've been, even in Europe, we've been dealing with wrongdoing and with you know, conflicts in this way of making good and of restoring and of dialoguing up to the 12th century. And it's funny because people never believe that. They always go like, what? Haven't we read in the history books about Greek and Roman society and all that, and that they've been, you know, punishing, hanging people on the cross and stuff like that? Yeah, that existed, but that was the exception. That was when you committed a very serious crime against the gods or against the king or the emperor or the state. So treason, you know, high treason, these kinds of things. Because otherwise, imagine, there was no internet, there was no telephone, there was no streets and cars and airplanes and all these kinds of things. These societies were less populated, and people were, the fastest means of transport was a horse. People lived in villages far away from you know, state infrastructure. So you couldn't always just go like, oh, my neighbor stole my cow. I'm going to go to the police. There was no police to go to in the first place. The judge would be maybe in the next city, and that would be maybe 50 kilometers away. So that is like with a horse, that's like a 2 days travel, and that is dangerous, and it costs time, and you need to be able to do that. So you need to have a horse, or you need to have the means, or you need to be able to leave your house, all of these things. So it's a system like the one that we have now is completely impossible to keep up or to organize in a society that has less infrastructure and that is less populated. What's the obvious thing to do? Well, the obvious thing to do is what humans have been doing for tens and thousands of years, is just to get together and to talk about it, and to make up to make things good. And most, wherever you look, all over the globe, in people still living in indigenous societies today, that's how they deal with harm. And this is how restorative justice came into being, is by white Westerners who were discontent with how the criminal justice system was working in the 70s. You know, in the 70s, there was this so-called crisis of the criminal justice system. There were many academic attacks on it. Michel Foucault is just one of the famous European ones. There is Angela Davis. There is Niels Christie. There is Thomas Matthiessen. There are, you know, many, many people who engaged in criminal in critical criminology and penal abolition, criticizing the carceral system, and you know, and in this attack, those are very very turbulent times, right? The 70s. There's, you know, loads of colonial liberation movements. There are alternative movements. There are social justice movements all over the place. People trying to do things differently. A lot of critical academia happening, and in this whole amalgam of movements and developments in society, people were looking for alternatives to the way the criminal justice system was working, and they were confronted with indigenous struggles for self-determination in countries where white settlement had happened, like what's now called Canada or the United States of America or New Zealand or Australia, because people there, First Nations there, were like demanding to be allowed to implement their own justice system, their traditional justice system. And so some white people were like, oh, that's interesting. Look at how they do it. You know, and many of the things that you know now, like, you know, certain parole measurements and alternatives to alternative ways of punishing. So not alternatives to punishment, but also alternative ways of punishment, like, you know, making people do community work, or that kind of stuff. It all, that all came into place in the 70s. There was a lot of criminal reform going on. All of this reform actually has only strengthened the criminal justice system. And, you know, it's now a thing that is so deeply implemented in our society that we have trouble in our minds to imagine dealing with harm and wrongdoing in a different way than by punishing. And it's, you know, it's so deeply anchored in ourselves now that we don't even know what's first hen or egg, criminal justice system or our desire to punish when we get hurt. So we've started to imitate it. When people hurt us in our relationships or in our daily life, we tend to think of how we can punish them. And sometimes we punish them, but this is our first reflex, right? We go, this guy has, or this person has promised to do this and that, and they haven't done it. So I'm not going to invite them for dinner again, something like that. And when we do this, actually, most of the time, our desire, our need, what we actually want when we react that way, is what people often say when you ask them. So, and you know, why do you want to revenge? Why do you want to punish the other person? It's like, I want, very often you have the quotation, I want them to feel the pain that I feel. I want them to hurt. I want them to hurt as bad as I hurt, because for them to then understand how bad they have hurt me. That is very well valid. That is very understandable. It doesn't work like that. But this need of the other person to hear how bad they have hurt you can be fulfilled by a process of dialogue, by getting together and talking about it, and you know, having your voice heard, and asking your questions. So now there's quite a lot of there is now a new branch of criminology called victimology. So the science of the science about victims, what it means to be a victim, and how that works. And they found out that victims often, what they want is, what they need, well, every victim is different, right? Every person who's harmed reacts differently, has different needs, but there are certain general things that we can find, and they are having questions that only the person responsible can answer, wanting to express how what happened affected them, so expressing their pain, hearing from the person how they came to do what they did, why they did it, in short, and also what can be done for them to not ever do that again to them or to another person. So there we have this actual aspect of the society and us as individuals becoming safer, being safer. And also, so last aspect is people wanting repair, wanting, you know, some kind of restoration. So either a financial contribution or something from the other, you know, person, when repairing the harm compensating in a financial or material way or in another way. And what people actually need and how they are connected and what they can do for each other is very individual, is very, very, very owned by them. Only they can know what they need. Only they can know how that specific situation that they were unfortunately put into, or that they got entangled with each other in a very unfortunate way, and they cannot undo this. Nothing can be undone. Things have been done, and they need to be addressed, but we can address them in a different way. And that is, you know, Nils Christie, a Norwegian critical criminologist and pioneer for restorative justice, said, a conflict has happened, and you know, when you become victimized, a conflict has been inflicted upon you. You have a conflict with that person, and whether you like it or not, and you never chose that, but that's the way it is. You have a conflict, and this conflict is owned by the people affected and concerned. And that conflict has been stolen by the criminal justice system. So they took it away. And it's interesting, because I said, you know, humankind have practiced these kinds of ways, these kinds of equal and personal and direct ways of dealing with harm for tens and thousands of years. So how did it happen that that Europeans find themselves in the situation that we're in right now, where we are completely colonized, our minds are colonized by the criminal justice system? And that is interesting. I just said earlier that it's the 12th century that is a turning point. And I'm going to make that very short, because it's quite a complex process. But to cut it short, we owe that to the Catholic Church and its lust for power, its ambitions to take over the power over the souls of the people. So they started to have these trials where the the compensation paid would be taxed, and that tax would go either to the emperor or to the church. And then later on, you know, you can see how little by little that tax became ever more important. And also, so the compensation was reduced. So the actual perpetrator, I'm going to use that word, even though it's a static conception of an individual who's done harm, the perpetrator paying something for some compensation to the victim, that gets more and more replaced by a fine that's being paid to the state, starting with this compensation being taxed and then sort of transforming into a fine, because the framing also changes from A hurt B, and that needs to be addressed and compensated and repaired, to A broke the law. And hence what you have is, instead of the victim, so sooner or later, instead of the victim sits on the other side at a trial, it's the prosecutor. Because now the defendant is not considered as a harm of another person or of another individual or of another being, but a breach of a law. And the framing of the church, and that's interesting because it shows us why we have this weird conception of punishment that is so closely related to suffering. In the idea of a certain interpretation of Catholic Christianism, when you breach a law, well, when you harm another person, or you commit a certain deed, you break the law, and hence you break the divine law. And breaking the divine law makes you a, how do you say that in English? Never mind. It makes you a sinner. There you go. Makes you a sinner. And in order to make good for a sin, the only way you can make up for that is by following the example of Jesus Christ and suffering. So in order to pay, you know, make good your sin, the only way you have is to suffer. And hence today, we still have this conception that people, in order to pay their guilt, not we talk about guilt, not about responsibility, in order to pay their guilt, they need to suffer. So we inflict harm on them by putting them into a prison and so on and so forth. I just mentioned this, and it's more complex. It might be a little bit weird the way I just put it here, because it's really shortcut, a quite complex social transformation process that happened between the 10th and the 14th century, roughly. I think it's really interesting to see how we still have this in our heads. We so completely engraved in our way of reacting to things, this idea of the perpetrator needing to suffer, and this whole disappropriation that we had, that we don't actually consider these kinds of events as our conflicts that are owned by us and that we could address together with everybody involved in and concerned and affected. So restorative justice came about as a concept adopted by Western white societies on models that they found in different indigenous practices. And the basic, I already mentioned this, you know, in here and there. So the basic principles of restorative justice are that it's voluntary, nobody can be forced to participate, and people speak to each other on equal terms, nobody has more power than others. It's about the main questions are what happened, who's been hurt, and how, and what do these people need, who's responsible to fulfill these needs. So you can see that these questions are quite open and are quite centered on making good and on giving people the possibility to make their voices heard and to search for solutions that are not predefined, that are not that do not follow a certain concept or a certain predefined frame. There are certainly principles, like I mentioned, and also the solution cannot rely on a person being involved that hasn't been present in the the process. So you cannot say between two people, we'll make X do something when X hasn't been there to say, yeah, I'm ready to do that. So it's consensual, and it's transformational. The idea is to see, you know, to understand the whole picture, how people ended up in this situation from all sides, and what happened with them, and what they need in order to move on, and either, you know, to move on and find peace together or separate. Like there is no obligation on whatsoever. People don't need to be friends after that or anything. People can very well decide that that they don't want anything to do with each other. It's up to them to find their solution, because only they can know what they need and what they can give. And it's very interesting, because often, so there are many different practices, many different ways of doing this. You have restorative circles coming from Rio de Janeiro. You have family group conferencing coming from New Zealand. You have healing circles coming from Indigenous people in North America. So there are many, many different ways of doing this, and the way we do it in Europe, although that it's very marginal still, is most of the time what is called victim-offender mediation. So a mediation between the people directly involved and affected during a criminal justice procedure. So that doesn't really involve the community. But what's really interesting is that when you do involve more people than just the ones who play the major roles, then you have the possibility to open up for much more transformative and general solutions, because you might find out that actually the person who did the harm out of a need or out of an emergency situation, be that economic, material, or emotional, and maybe, you know, in order for things to move on and things to be better and safer afterwards, we need to address their needs too and find out what they, you know, how we can support them in order to not do again what they did. So I've been talking for roughly an hour. I think it's up to you to hit me with your questions and comments. And I'm sure there are so many, and there's so much confusion, because it is really changing a paradigm. It is really changing the way of how we relate to each other, and how we are in the world, and how we see each other. It's not just, you know, staying who we are and adapting a new method and not changing society or ourselves or the way we are in society. Penal abolition and restorative and transformative justice are really a change of paradigm of the way that you see the world, the way that you are in the world, the way that you relate to each other and to reality, the way that we create reality together. It is also one of the steps, one of the points that we need to make, one of the, how can I say this, one of the tasks that we, one of the jobs that we have to do in order to decolonize ourselves, as Westerners who have inflicted this bullshit justice system on the whole world and on ourselves, and to decolonize ourselves and our minds from this justice system that is based on oppression, on separation, on a dualistic and very stigmatizing and static way of relating to the world, of looking at the world, and of treating each other. I would be ready for you guys now. Let me have a look. If I had any messages, if I'm waiting for the facilitator. Hello, would you like to hit me with what people might be saying? We seem to have a technical, I can't hear you. Ah, it's so much nicer if we could, you know, all be in a room together. Ah, now I hear you. I imagine. Do I have an example of including the victim's needs in the punishment process? The way the criminal justice system works is actually the victims are just witnesses, right? So once you have reported something that happened to you to the police, you then get the status of a witness, and a witness is only addressed and asked if their testimony is needed. So you might find yourself in a situation, and that happens quite often, where the criminal justice system does their thing without ever asking your testimony or your opinion anyway. But if they do ask you and you need to testify in court, then you answer questions that they define, that the questions that they find interesting. So often those would be questions like, did they hold the bottle like this or like this, and did they stand like this or like this, and was their jacket blue or brown? And you'd be like, what's all this got to do? Like, I have completely different things here that are interesting to me. I would like to talk about how I feel and what it did to me and what I need now in order to be better and so on. And all that doesn't really count. Now, there is a new development in European lawmaking. There is this European Union Victims Directive that asks member states to consider the victim more in criminal justice procedures. And that's one reason why they've tried to push forward restorative justice practices in the member states, because restorative justice is one way of trying to consider victims' needs more. So you can, for example, the state attorney can, before opening the trial in front of court or before referring the case to court, can ask people if, you know, can refer the file to a mediation service, and they can ask people where they would like to have a victim offender mediation. And the judge can do the same too. If the attorney hasn't done it, the judge can do so. And then people's voices can be heard in the mediation process. And then the outcome of that mediation process can be taken into consideration by the court or by the attorney, and they can include it in their decision. That is one way of making them of including victims more in the criminal justice procedure. Another one is the so-called victim impact statements, which I don't really like very much because they are often used in order to plead for harsher punishment. And it's completely not the same to proclaim a written statement in front of court where you say how you are, then meeting up with the person who harmed you in a safe environment that is, you know, where you and the other people are prepared beforehand to that meeting, and where you actually meet on terms where you can really listen to each other and feel safe, and where you can also stop when you've had enough, or when it's too much. Whereas court, I don't know if people have been to court already. Like, I've certainly been to court in all different roles, as defendant, testifying, and so on. And it's court is the setup of court is such a weird piece of theater. I mean, it starts with these people who act there being weirdly disguised with their black little things, and some, you know, in some states they even wear wigs and stuff. And it's very strictly organized and defined. There's, you know, there's this and that, and then that person speaks, and then that, and it's very, you know, it's got a very unreal language, the language of law that we might even not understand. It's the opposite. Like a court, like a courtroom is the opposite of a space where people can meet and really listen and to each other and engage in each other's presence. I don't see that it's very, you know, I don't see any very promising ways of involving victims more in the criminal justice procedure. I think we need to, you know, do different things. We need to do other things than criminal justice. Oh, on peut le faire en français. Hein? We could do this in French too. I don't have a script. I know that this is being recorded, and it will stay in the Class Computer Club's media archive, so you can always listen to it again. I have a website, risimalsan.net, where you can contact me if you want, you know, if you have any questions. And I wrote a book called in German, and it's called Strafe und Gefängnis, Theoriekritik Alternativen. It came out in 2018 in Schmetterling Verlag. So if you like to read more about, you know, theories and critiques of punishment and the penal system and alternatives, you can look at my book. I mean, there are penal abolitionists all over the place. If you look for a French penal abolitionist, you have Geoffroy de Laganerie, you have Didier Fassin, who also wrote an amazing book very recently. Don't have the title right now, but if you Google him, Didier Fassin, you can find him. And you've got Catherine Baker, who's a very prominent French abolitionist. If you're happy to do a transcription of my talk, well, there you go. But otherwise, there are other people than me who've talked about this. Interesting question. I think I never had that one. I think this is, if you so like, this is almost a question about revolutionary theory, right? How do we overturn the government, or how do we change the society? How do we how do we force the dominant class and the ruling the people who have ruling power? How do we make them change? How do we make them stop? How do we take them out of office? very difficult question. I think the thing is that we I see the thing that I think panel abolitionism as a very important and main pillar of the oppressive society system in which we live, but it's not the only one, and it's certainly intertwined with many many ways of many structural oppressive other structural oppressive pillars. It if we only try to change the way we deal with harm, so if we only try to change the justice system without changing the rest of of society, we won't get anywhere. We can't just change that and leave the whole class stratification into classes and racism and sexism and so on. We can't just leave that the way it is, where people have more power than others and can always dominate others, and just change the way we talk about harm, right? And the way, and say, okay, let's not put people into prison anymore. Let's let's just have circles. I see it like I see it like a part of that, because on the other hand, if you have a revolution, say we have a revolution, right? I think we're in desperate need of some kind of revolution. If we have if we overthrow the way this society works, if we radically change and transform that without addressing how we deal with harm, we'll end up the way that these kinds of trials ended up in the 20th century. Communists and anarchist essays of overthrowing societies and changing stuff, they've never really addressed that. And they stayed in this punitive way of dealing with things. And they created the most horrendous systems of punishment, because they stayed in this, if you so want, they stayed in this way of being in the world that is, disconnected, and in this idea of inflicting pain in order to for people to make good, because people have to suffer and so on. They stayed in this whole ideology. They didn't address that at all. If we don't address that, then our revolution is not complete, and it will be it can become something completely monstrous. And the way I see it is that we don't, there might be moments where we have to take quite strong action, but in general, it's a process where we can take any little steps. And for example, if we could start by tomorrow releasing everybody who's in prison for minor stuff like using public transport without without a ticket, and other very low offensive things. We could start by looking at how other societies deal with stuff, and do the way people do it in Norway or in some examples in Canada, where actually we take away people's freedom because we don't know how else to deal with them right now, because we consider them dangerous, or we think that they have some serious issues that they need to look at. But taking their freedom is the point, not making them suffer in the way we take their freedom. So we could, for example, put them in a place where they can't access, where they don't have access to us, but where they can live a decent life and where they have support structures that help them to be better. And that would already be like almost revolutionary, because if you tell people that there's no reason why people should be should be put away and suffer, it's like, wow, people with like, as if how to say that? I mean, you all know this kind of tabloid thing where, oh my God, prisons, people in prison are like in a luxury hotel and stuff. And as if they don't suffer, if they don't, if it's not, it's no good. But that was never the point, to make them suffer. The point of the criminal justice system is to take away their freedom. So there are many, many little points where we can start, and where we can, many strings that we can pull, and already have a very different way of approaching things. So we don't actually have to just, turn the switch, and go from total criminal justice system to total restorative justice. We can get there by doing one step after the other, and by pulling, addressing certain aspects and changing stuff. So we have more of the one and less of the other. Today we have a lot of criminal justice, a lot of punitive measures, and very little restorative measures. We could turn that around and say, okay, we keep the punitive system for when we don't know what else to do, because there might be moments where we don't know what else to do. But we could increase all restorative ways of addressing, and that would already make such a big difference. I don't know if that answered your question, but yeah. Oh, I know. Yes. Is there another short one? Can you give me another short? Come on, another a little one. I can be short. Yeah, I know I talk a lot. There's so much to say. I think I just included that in what I just said, that sometimes we don't know what to do with people, but we can change the conditions under which they are put away. We don't need to put them in cages where they suffer, and where they can't decide what to wear and what to eat and when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed. We might have to sometimes put people away because we don't know what else to do, but we can do this differently. And there are many examples all over the world, actually, where this is done in a different way, like in Norway and Canada and Brazil. If you want more. Yeah, the Zapatistas are a very good example, and so is the Kurdish movement in Rojava. I mean, they experiment with this kind of thing. Totally, they try to create a different justice system based on dialogue and repair and restoration. But sometimes they don't have a choice, and they need to resort to coercive measures. But it's not the main thing. That's the point, I think. Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. And again, I mean, yeah, you can, if you want to contact me, just have a look at my website or on the Twitter. My Twitter handle is really Razy. I can imagine there is always more questions in the end than in the beginning. That's what penal abolitionism is like. So many questions. Bye, everyone. Thanks for joining.